I don't think we can count on consumers, companies, or investors. And so that's my concern, is that CSR, ESG reporting creates an impression that the corporate world on its own through voluntary action will address these things. And I don't think that's tenable.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore topics in biodiversity conservation and the environment more broadly, and interrogate conventional wisdom in this field for the sake of a more robust case for conservation. I'm your host, Andre Marder. ESG is the latest buzzword in business and biodiversity circles, but is not actually new, only newly popular, and is one among many terms and acronyms in this field which may be familiar but often poorly understood. ESG stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance Investing Criteria. Understanding concepts like ESG is consequential because their success relies largely on convincing the general public of their value and their virtue. As we discussed in this episode, however, they're not necessarily all that they're made out to be. To elucidate this topic with me is Ken Pucker. Ken is a professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and advisory director at the Boston-based financial services firm Berkshire Partners. He was previously chief operating officer of the outdoor footwear and apparel company Timberland, one of the first companies to take an interest in sustainable production. He's written extensively on ESG and related issues in Harvard Business Review, among other publications. To start off with, I asked Ken to explain what ESG is meant to be and where it fits into the broader corporate responsibility arena.
These terms, unfortunately, are ill-defined, which serves lots of corporate interests. But I'll start with corporate social responsibility, evolve into sustainability, and then return to the question of ESG. Corporate social responsibility really started around the turn of the century, in large part as a result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. There was an organization founded in Boston called Ceres, a kind of response to the spill, and another organization that spun out of Ceres called GRI, which stands for the Global Reporting Initiative, to try to begin to define standards for companies to prepare reports on non-financial impacts. And by non-financial impacts, I mean things like carbon emissions and water emissions and board diversity and things that you wouldn't find typically reported in financial statements. And GRI grew pretty quickly. It's a pretty arcane and complex set of reporting standards. The first multinational company to report using GRI standards, ironically, was Shell Oil. But the company that I had the joy to work for, Timberland, was one of the probably first 10 publicly traded companies to issue a, at the time, corporate social responsibility report. And if you look over time between 2000 and today, you'll see that corporate social responsibility reporting has grown enormously, kind of exponentially, especially over the last 10 years. We're at the point now that more than 95% of S&P 500 companies prepare annually a CSR report. And so on the one hand, you think that's real progress because there is more reporting and more disclosure on non-financial impacts. And given the fact that these impacts are becoming more acute and pressing, that seems like progress. Around the same time, actually in 2004, Kofi Annan and the UN were sponsoring a movement that he called the Global Compact, which was a way actually to introduce business into the realm of governance to try to solve some of these growing social environmental challenges. And an offshoot of the Global Impact was a smaller group that was focused on the world of investment and finance, who published a report called Who Cares Wins in 2004, where they introduced the term ESG. And they didn't define it intentionally, but they did say it was increasingly necessary for companies to both present this information and for investors to push companies to improve on these measures. And ESG as a term sat out there, but didn't really get much adoption. Behind the scenes, there was the beginnings of an investor movement called the social responsible investing. It grew over time with a couple of ratings firms that tried to rate companies on the basis of their social responsibility. And it was a niche within the world of investment, socially responsible investing, very small, committed group. There was a firm called Domini, another one called Trillium that focused on this, but very small kind of corner of the world in investing. That endured until really kind of the 2010s. And in the 2010s, a number of things, two things in particular occurred that created tailwind for this ESG investing idea. One was the adoption by MSCI of ratings for corporations that were based on lots more data that was in part enabled by the companies preparing these CSR reports. MSCI bought KLD and they bought another ratings firm and began to aggregate and kind of commercialize this idea. And the second was academic papers started to come out that demonstrated that there was a correlation between companies that were good performers on social responsibility and share price, both corporate profits and share price. Mm-hmm. There were two papers in particular, both had ties to Harvard. One looked at 90 paired studies of companies. So like consider a Walmart and a Kmart, and dubbed one a high sustainability company and one a low sustainability company, and looked at their performance over 18 years and found out over the first 7 years, there wasn't much divergence. But after that, there was a pretty consequential divergence on the order of 500 basis points, which is enormous in the world of investing. Another paper came out the following year that looked at, well, what about companies looking at ones that performed well on material corporate responsibility measures versus ones that performed well on immaterial corporate social responsibility measures, to look at kind of the, does focus actually engender better performance? And they came up with a result that was even better, that said there were 600 basis points of opportunity. And so the asset management world, meaning people like Fidelity and State Street and Vanguard, became interested in productizing this idea of CSR. And that's when ESG investing started to really grow. They had ratings that made it look like it was scientific. They had investor demand because, you know, people were getting increasingly concerned about climate change and biodiversity loss and the like. They had evidence from the academic community that said it might, you know, doing well leads to doing good. And they needed to find a product, meaning the asset management industry, that allowed them to actively manage more funds because they can charge higher fees. Mm-hmm. Meaning in the background of all this, there was a big shift in the asset management industry from actively managed funds to passive funds. And those are lower returning funds for asset management. So they needed more active products. And so ESG became a nice, convenient, well-timed solution because there was demand for it. There was science behind it. There were ratings behind it. So it started to get commercialized. And if you look at the trajectory, even though the term existed since 2004, it really didn't pick up until 2016, 17, 18, 19, and really peaked in the 2020, 2021 period. One more complication is that what companies used to call CSR reports, over time, that moniker shifted to sustainability reports. And now they're often called ESG reports. Okay, even though ESG is really just a way to invest, it's gotten conflated with a way to report because it's become so popular. Mm-hmm. Companies want to speak the vernacular of their investors, who are their shareholders. And so the terminology really is pretty messy.
In preparing for this, I was quite shocked to discover that ESG, as far as I could understand, is mostly about impacts of the environment on companies rather than the impact of companies on the environment. With everything you've explained so far, one would think, okay, fair enough, there are some problems with it, but at least companies are kind of doing better for the environment. But this one fact seems to indicate otherwise. And I was just wondering, how has something so stark been escaping scrutiny so far?
It's fascinating. I think part of the confusion stems from the epithet itself. I mean, ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. And so the brand itself connotes something positive for the environment or for social outcomes. Mm-hmm. But were one, for example, to pull the prospectus of a large ESG fund, which is public. So consider BlackRock, who's the world's largest asset manager, has a fund called the US Carbon Readiness Transition Fund. Mm-hmm. They launched it in April a year ago and raised over $2 billion in one day. One would think that would contain the equities of companies like Tesla or Orsted or companies that are making long duration batteries or other kind of solutions for climate issues. But in fact, the companies that are represented by the top 10 companies are companies like Facebook and Google and Apple and JP Morgan Chase and Johnson & Johnson and Exxon and Tesla. It's a traditional basket that would be very similar to a basket of securities from a S&P 500 index fund. Mm-hmm. And you think, wait a minute, I thought this was an ESG fund. Well, the ratings that I alluded to earlier, MSCI's ratings, they are based on what you rightly described as the impact of the planet on the company's resilience, on its profit and loss statement. Mm-hmm. So it examines things like, does the company have factories in floodplains? Does the company have risk of reputational loss due to work practice issues? Mm-hmm. Does the company have exposure to change in the regulatory environment that would impact their gross margins? That's what they're looking at. And that's one important point. The second important point is ESG ratings are done vertically, not horizontally, meaning MSCI is looking at an A is an A for the oil and gas industry, mm-hmm. or an A is an A for the tech industry or healthcare industry. It's not rating a healthcare company against a fossil fuel company. It's rating a fossil fuel company against its peers. And so if an index fund of ESG securities is being put together by an asset manager, they can pick, let's say, all A-rated ESG A-rated companies and get a portfolio that looks like the one I just described to you. That's not a portfolio that's good for the planet. Mm-hmm. It may be a portfolio of companies that is actually resilient to planetary shifts, but is not one that's good for the planet. I should make, to complicate matters, note that the vast majority of raters do rate the way I just described, the impact of the planet on the company. That's called single materiality. There are rating services, mostly ones that appeal to European asset managers and asset owners, that use a different formula. It's called double materiality, that look at both the impact of the planet on the company and the impact of the company on the planet. And increasingly, there's a divergence between the US and Europe in terms of what the right way to apply ESG investing is. And that's an open question.
I've heard in a couple of your other discussions that you've pinpointed three particular, perhaps slightly more subtle concerns than the one that I pointed to a moment ago about ESG. Would you mind elaborating a little on each of those and maybe just to briefly summarize that I see if I understand them? But first was the fact that higher fees are charged for ESG investing. Secondly, the fact that investors are under the impression that they're doing environmental good when they are not necessarily doing so. And thirdly, that it creates kind of a laziness among policymakers. And I've heard you say that that third one is your main concern of the three. Have I got that more or less right?
Perfect. Fees is easy. It returns to part of what we were talking about a bit earlier, which is most ESG funds, not all, but most are actively managed funds, which have higher fees than passive funds. On average, a recent study showed that ESG funds carry 40% higher fees than traditional funds. Again, this is something that not all investors know. One would hope that institutional investors, pension funds, endowments, college endowments, know this because they're more sophisticated. But certainly retail investors like you or I probably don't do enough research to understand this. Mm-hmm. The second you referenced is that most investors are confused because they think they're putting their money behind an asset class that actually does well and does good. And if you want to come back to that academic research, which I think is pretty flawed. And so an anecdote, I was presenting as part of a panel not long ago. The panel was called The Origins and Efficacy of ESG Investing. And I made the case, as I am now, that it's not much different than traditional investing and certainly won't positively impact planetary welfare. Mm-hmm. And after I got off stage, other people disagreed. A woman came up to me as a PhD student and said, "Dude, I have $2,500 in savings, and I need to figure out how to invest it such that I'm advancing planetary welfare, but I'm not wealthy, and I can't afford concessionary returns, and I need a portfolio that's diversified and liquid. What should I do?" And I said, "Well, you should vote, because I think policy is the biggest driver of change." And she said, "I already do that. You haven't answered my question." And I paused and I thought, you know, I don't have a good answer. Let me figure this out and get back to you. And so actually I've spent the last 3 months interviewing a bunch of people that I consider to be really capable in this world and in the world of what's known as impact investing, which, by the way, is a separate category from ESG. I can talk about it if you'd like. Mm-hmm. And I found out there aren't great answers to the question. You know, if you're a retail investor and ESG is a high fee vehicle that doesn't have planetary impact, which is what I contend, then where are you supposed to put your money? Because there are categories like impact investing and climate tech venture investing and private equity impact funds and blended finance, which are good for the planet, but they're not accessible to a retail investor. Mm-hmm. I can't call up TPG or Bain Capital and say, "Hey, I've got $2,500. They wouldn't take my money. And so the problem is that investors that are increasingly interested in investing, data says this, 85% of a recent survey said 85% of retail investors want to invest for planetary welfare. There aren't good options. And yet they think they're being provided an option when they invest in an ESG fund, but they're really not. Mm-hmm. So that's a concern I have, because I do think we need to deploy far more capital to address these planetary challenges. And yet people may think they're doing that when we're not, they're not.
Right. Maybe now is a good time to ask you about impact investing. How does that fit in with ESG? I mean, if you look at just the terms alone, it sounds like it might be a subset of ESG.
You know, it depends on who's defining and how they classify. I would agree with you that a lot of people do classify impact as a subset of ESG. Mm-hmm. ESG often encompasses a number of different investing styles. So I'll give you a couple: thematic investing, which is investing in a theme like climate change. So you might invest in renewable energy companies. You might invest in an aluminum canning company because you think the world's going to shift from plastic. So there's a thematic category. The biggest category is called negative screen, which means you're just creating a fund where you're not investing in a particular industry. It could be tobacco, could be firearms, could be fossil fuels. Another category is called ESG integration, which is a big category. It's the one I've principally been talking about, where you look at non-financial factors to make your investment judgments. Another one's impact, which we'll talk about. Another one's positive screen. I mean, so there's a lot of different categories within this moniker called ESG.
Impact. And sorry to interrupt, but also overlap between them. Are they kind of distinct categories, or is there overlap between them? Is it sort of a messy mix?
Messy mix. You can get double counting. You could have a negative screen fund that's also an ESG integration fund, for example. And by the way, that's a problem because most data on the size of ESG investing is self-reported and oftentimes double counted. Sometimes you have the double counting you just described, meaning a fund is two things. Sometimes you have double counting where surveys go to about asset managers and asset owners. That's the same pool of capital and it's being double counted. So much so that the principal trade body called USSIF, which tracks sustainable investing or ESG investing, just cut their own estimate of the size of the asset class in half.
Wow.
Okay, so they've been reporting for 10 years. They just said that 2 years ago, they said the category was $18 trillion, which is enormous. This year, they said 8.5.
When you say the category, you mean ESG?
Yes.
You're talking about ESG, right?
Yes. By the way, the Europeans are in the process of looking at the same recategorization, and there will be a similar kind of reform or decline in what they say the category is. No change in really the asset pool, just a change in how counting is done because of some of these problems and how diffuse the definitions are. Mm-hmm. To your question about impact investing is investing that is done in order to affect social or environmental outcomes while delivering financial returns. It has in its mandate specifically that it has to deliver improved social and environmental outcomes. GIIN, G-I-I-N, the Global Impact Investing Network, came out with their study recently that said for the first time in 2002, global impact investing topped $1 trillion. And so you know how that compares. The professionally managed global investing universe is probably somewhere between $100 and $120 trillion. So it's very small as a percent of total. Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of impact investing, impact first or finance first, right? So impact first means, you know, family offices who are wealthy may want to invest in remediating an environmental crisis, and they don't really care about financial returns. It's a quasi-philanthropic investment. Mm-hmm. And then financial first means, no, we're not willing to concede financial returns. We want this investment to deliver both financial returns and social and environmental outcomes. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of ways to be an impact investor. There's venture, there's private equity or growth capital, there's this quasi-philanthropy, there's lots of ways to go about it. And I think it's actually a wonderful thing, although it's very small relative to our need. And a good deal of impact investing is concessionary, meaning I'm rich enough that I can decide that I have $100,000 or $1 million that I want to invest in prison recidivism. Okay, is this something I'm concerned about? And so I make that investment and I don't necessarily need a market return back. Mm-hmm. Most investors, almost all institutional investors, have a mandate that says they must deliver the highest possible return because they're investing on the behalf of universities or pensioners, et cetera. And they don't have the ability to be impact first investors. It's not consistent with their fiduciary mandate. Mm. And so I don't think we can look for impact investing alone to solve or address our growing and pressing social and environmental challenges.
Right. Okay. I was just wondering, if did we finish all three of the concerns? I sidetracked you at least once.
No problem. We missed one.
Yeah, you spoke about the higher fees you spoke about, and which is fairly simple, as you said, and then the fact that investors think that they're doing more good than they are. I think you more or less covered that, right? But the third one, the most important one, as far as you're concerned, I don't think we'd quite covered yet.
Right. And so from my perspective, there's a number of key leverage points that we can look at to help address social and environmental challenges. One is consumer behavior. One is corporate behavior. Another is investor behavior. We can talk about each of those. I think that none of those ultimately will be sufficient for different reasons, but mostly because of how our system structure, rules, and incentives are set up. And so that leaves policymakers as the principal powerful lever. And I think there's good evidence that policy shifts or rule changes essentially can drive different consumer, corporate, or investor behavior such that we accelerate our conversion to a system and an energy system and a consumption patterns that now allow us to come back to living within planetary boundaries. In the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act is one such illustration. Now, it did pass by all of one vote, and so it was really tenuous. But I think there's good evidence already that it is accelerating a transition in EVs, in electricity generation, in reduction in carbon capture, in long-term battery storage. The catalyst that the subsidies have provided is going to enable the U.S., I think, to come pretty close to delivering on its 2030 objective of reducing its carbon footprint by, I think, 42% from like a 20. I'm not sure what the starting point was, but those are those kinds of things. That's why I said vote to the PhD student, because those kinds of interventions can have a profound impact. Whereas I think that the ESG investing and corporate reporting worlds are more performative. There's actually more evidence that they don't lead to good social and environmental outcomes than that they do. And my concern is that lay people will think that because a company issues a CSR report, that means they're tending to social environmental risks. And there, it doesn't. There's a big difference between reporting and disclosure. Okay, they're different things, meaning corporate social responsibility reports are voluntary. They are unregulated. And if I want to report on my scope one or scope two carbon emissions, I can. If I want to report comprehensively on all my scopes of emissions, I can. And so there's a big difference between providing a report and being honest about disclosure. And then there's a gap between disclosure and action. Just because I tell you that I'm timberland and my carbon emissions are XYZ in a CSR report, do you think that changes citizen or consumer behavior? My contention is it doesn't. Maybe on the margins, maybe 2 or 3% of consumers even would look up that information, but it is complicated. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we can count on consumers, companies, or investors. And so that's my concern, is that CSR, ESG reporting creates an impression that the corporate world on its own through voluntary action will address these things. And I don't think that's tenable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and after all, I mean, the corporate sector is responsible to its shareholders, right? So it's kind of unreasonable to expect that they would, you know, they would put social and environmental issues first. I was wondering, do you think that good ESG or good corporate responsibility is theoretically possible? So is it a case of just getting better at it, or do you think the idea is fundamentally flawed? And perhaps you partly answered this question, but if you wouldn't mind humoring me.
So I'm going to distinguish for a minute between, you asked about two things, both corporate social responsibility and ESG. And so I'll first focus on the CSR, the corporate side of things, not the investor side of things. And if you'll permit me, I'll read to you from an editorial that appeared in the Wall Street Journal in 2010, written by an academic named Anil Karnani, who is from the University of Michigan. He wrote an editorial called "The Case Against Corporate Social Responsibility." And he says, very simply, in cases where private profits and public interests are aligned, the idea of corporate social responsibility is irrelevant. Companies that simply do everything they can to boost profits will end up increasing social welfare. Mm-hmm. In circumstances in which profits and social welfare are in direct opposition, an appeal to corporate social responsibility will almost always be ineffective, because executives are unlikely to act voluntarily in the public interest against shareholder interests. A longer way of saying what you just said, which is, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility and their jobs and their incomes depend on delivering traditional profit growth, share price improvements. It's hard to then, you know, go off the reservation and start paying a fair price for carbon emissions if your competitors aren't. And so on the margins, there are solutions that are win-wins. Things like install LED lightings or convert now your fleet to an EV fleet. There are wins that are good for the environment and good for profit, but they're 10% of the total. They're not 90. Mm-hmm. And so that's my answer for you on this, on the corporate side. On the ESG side, I don't think ESG is going to have any, done right, the way it's currently being done, I think it has almost virtually no effect on planetary welfare. Mm-hmm. I do think there are categories of ESG, like we talked about, like impact investing or climate tech investing, that do have an impact, but they're small.
Meanwhile, ESG has really kind of captured the public imagination, right? And it's captured the media to the extent that, I mean, people like me you know, hear the word and it sounds good. And therefore you know, there's kind of a certain comfort in taking action, like investing in a so-called ESG compliant company and then kind of, you know, sitting back, getting on with your busy life and feeling like you've made a difference, right?
We do want to make an investment that we think is beneficial and feel better about ourselves. There's a good paper that a number of academics in Switzerland wrote that's called "Do Investors Care About Impact?" And I wish I knew all their names, but I don't remember top of mind. But they did an extensive study and found out that, in fact, consumers do care about impact, but they don't have the bandwidth, nor do they care enough to go measure the impact. So essentially, if you tell them they're doing impact that's positive at a level of a scale of 1 or 100, they're reasonably indifferent. Meaning they want their money to be doing something that's comforting, as you described, that's good. But demonstrating the impact is very difficult. It's very hard to figure out marginal effects of what your $10 did versus someone else's investment. Would the company have done it anyway? What's the counterfactual? It's very complicated. Mm-hmm. And so I think investors just say, look, I want my money to be doing good, right? Kind of give me the stamp of approval. But after that, how much good and would I pay more for it to do more good? Less certain on those fronts. Mm-hmm. And I think ESG really appeals to that want to feel good idea. But I worry that it's like empty calories.
Mm-hmm. Something else, and this is maybe a slight divergence in the discussion, but something else I was wondering, and I mentioned that I'd had this recent discussion with a lawyer on the podcast. I asked her a similar question, but I think you're probably better placed to answer it. What are the consequences of responsible companies and responsible countries doing the responsible thing? And then, you know, less responsible companies just shopping around for a country that's willing to put them up, and vice versa. You know, the less responsible countries opening their arms to companies that that don't care too much about the environment or society. What's to prevent us from having that sort of a shopping around effect?
Very little. Actually, I have a great deal of experience with this one because my professional career was mostly spent in the footwear and apparel industry. And footwear and apparel has been an itinerant industry. When I started in the industry, for example, I worked at Timberland for 15 years. We made 100% of our own footwear in our own factories, three of which were in the United States, one in North Carolina, one in Tennessee, one in Puerto Rico, and one was in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. I actually had the great honor of leading one of our factories in Puerto Rico for 2 years as my second job at Timberland. And by the time I left, we had one factory. We had closed three, the two U.S. mainland facilities plus the one in Puerto Rico. And interestingly, in our case, we were one of the last holdouts who continued to make footwear in the United States because the owner of the company was not convinced by lower labor costs. He was not convinced that that was a good idea. In large part because he thought we had innovative capability and intellectual property in our own factories that couldn't be matched overseas. And so even though we paid our workers on average probably 15 times what we could have paid for an outsourced factory worker in China or Vietnam, we continued to keep the factories open until he made a trip with me to China. And we visited the largest footwear manufacturer in the world called Pou Chen. And they took us through their vertically integrated supply chain that was akin to like what River Rouge must have been like for Ford. They had mold making shops. They had leather making tanneries. They had chemical making facilities. They had finished goods factories. They had innovation facilities. I mean, mind boggling capability. And on the plane, on the way back, he said, let's close our factories. And I said, why? I mean, you haven't been convinced for 10 years. What did it? He said, they have the innovative capability that we don't have. There's no one training to be a footwear engineer in the United States anymore. Okay, the industry's gone. Tanneries have left. And in large part, in the tannery space, they left because of what you're talking about, which is environmental arbitrage, meaning when the laws changed here that made it more expensive to dump your effluent in the river, tanneries moved overseas, where the regulation wasn't as stringent. Mm. And so the industry is pretty itinerant. And in large part, it's because they're chasing low wages and also less stringent regulations, which drive cost. And so companies will migrate to places where they can, you know, obviously find more innovation capability, but also lower cost.
Yeah, I often wonder, you know, there's a lot, I try not to sort of focus on particular people or particular countries on the podcast, but it's kind of, there's nothing like China, right? There's no country in the world like it. And I often wonder, there's a lot spoken about how China is developing their renewable energy. I mean, they're already producing most of the materials for renewable energy around the world. But I also can't help thinking that they will keep that up as long as it serves the interests of the government. And as soon as anything changes, you know, basically they're not doing it for the good of the world, and put it that way.
You're making a really interesting point, which is I think of China as a bit gray. There's enormous pockets of things that are hopeful, like you're talking about in terms of renewable energy generation, investment in capability. The largest, for example, battery manufacturer in the world, CATL or CATL, is in China. They've just announced a new battery that has twice the energy density of the most significant lithium ion battery now, which will extend the range of vehicles to 600 miles.
Unbelievable.
I mean, they're doing amazing things like that. At the same time, they're building more coal-fired facilities to keep the lights on than anywhere else in the world. And so there's good and bad. I would urge your listeners, if they're interested in this question, to read a book by a guy named Jonathan Watts, who's a journalist from the Financial Times, who wrote a book probably 10 years old by now, called When a Billion Chinese Jump. And he travels through different provinces and talks about geopolitics and environment in each province. And it's genius. I mean, I thought it was fantastic.
I'll definitely look that up and put it in the show notes as well. Meanwhile, you know, back in the West and what we know best, ESG has come under quite a lot of scrutiny recently. And you're not the only person calling it out in quite major publications. And that seems to be, that sort of counter narrative seems to be gathering quite a bit of steam. But one thing I haven't seen you speak about explicitly is the importance of transparency, which to me seems to be perhaps the most important sort of buzzword that needs to be applied. You know, that because companies are, they can only be expected to look after the interests of their shareholders. The best that we can hope for is decent regulation and as much transparency as possible, because otherwise, you know, ESG will be used as a screen to hide behind, I guess. So I'm just wondering whether you would agree that transparency is a really key concept, or if you could sort of put me right in my thinking.
So two things. One is, you're right that ESG is coming under more scrutiny, and you're right to note that I'm certainly not the only one who's made the point. There's a guy named Tarek Fancy, who was at BlackRock for 2 years as the chief investment officer for their ESG work, who wrote a piece in the Toronto Globe and Mail that was wildly critical, and then has subsequently written a lot about the gap between rhetoric and reality. There's a woman named Desiree Fixler, who was a whistleblower at Deutsche Bank, who has written a lot about this as well. So there are people talking about it. I want to distinguish, though, between two types of criticisms of ESG. There's the kind that we've been talking about, which I describe it as kind of empty calories. The second type of criticism, which is now in vogue, is from Republican state treasurers who view ESG as woke and a deliberate attempt by liberals to impose their values on pensioners and things like that. I consider that to be complete hogwash. Okay, that argument. I mean, evidence the fact, like I told you before, that ESG funds invest in fossil fuel companies. So I think that's really just political theater and really not worth investing much time on. Second point, which is about transparency and the importance of transparency. I'm less sanguine. I'm all for transparency, to be clear. I do think that, for example, corporate social responsibility reports should be regulated, and I think they should be mandated, like corporate financial reports. However, per what I was describing earlier, just because something is reported doesn't mean behavior changes. And I'll give you an example. In the United States, post the 2008 financial meltdown, we passed a law called Sarbanes-Oxley, which mandated, among other things, that publicly traded companies above a certain threshold, their CEOs report annually their annual compensation and the ratio of their compensation to the average worker at their company, starting in the year 2017. And so we have some runway here. And the idea was, if we shine a light on this, that CEOs and boards will be shamed into the fact that this gap continues to grow. It's now 330-1, okay, in the United States. And what happened since the reporting is that the gap has grown. There wasn't shame. And by the way, no one pays attention to it because it's buried in some report that the SEC reads. And so we have transparency now. but we don't have behavior change. Another good example in this country is we had a law passed a number of years ago that forced restaurants above a certain size to publish calorie information on their menus because we thought that information would cause people to eat healthier and the obesity problem in this country would go down. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that one hasn't worked either. And so I'm all for transparency. Mm-hmm. But we have now a rule pending at the SEC looking at whether companies that are public have to report on their full emissions profiles. I think they should. I think it's existential. But I don't think that alone is going to change much behavior.
Right. It's kind of necessary, but not sufficient.
Absolutely. And I think in certain cases, disclosure can change behavior. In the case of, let's say, carbon emissions, I'm really skeptical. I mean, if I'm going to buy a T-shirt, and am I going to go look at a filing from the two companies that make the T-shirt and be able to discern the carbon emissions of each T-shirt? The answer is absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I won't even get the division. I won't get the product line. I'll get the aggregate emissions. And so it's a long way from a purchase decision to a report that lists total emissions.
On the topic of complexity, biodiversity is considered to be more complex than climate change. Are you familiar with TCFD and TNFD?
Yes.
I'll explain the acronyms in the intro. But do you think that either of them, okay, so TCFD is the climate one that's been around for a few years already. Do you think that TCFD has had some positive effect? And do you think TNFD, which is coming out later this year, the framework will come out later this year, do you think that is likely to have much of an impact?
I'm not sufficiently expert on TNFD to make a judgment, nor am I really expert on TCFD. But I think I'd go back to what we were talking about, which is, you know, TCFD is pretty extensive reporting requirements, including scenario planning for climate, including narrative on the connection of climate physical risk and climate transition risk to corporate performance. I think these are things companies should be thinking about. I think it's things that investors should be aware of. I think this information should be reported. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't believe that reporting is a substitute for policy shift. You know, if I could wave a magic wand, I would impose a carbon price of $200 per metric ton tomorrow, mm-hmm. globally. And I would think that would have a far bigger effect than any, you know, mandatory reporting because of how companies respond to incentives. And, you know, if it cost a lot more to pollute, I would work hard to find a way not to pollute.
Mm-hmm. And just my last question, actually, but it relates a little bit to what you said about the kind of right-wing critique of ESG. There's a guy who I'm sure you're very familiar with, Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yes.
One of the key critiques that he makes of ESG, and he's coming pretty much from the right, is that we've spoken quite a lot about ESG being responsibility to shareholders, but the idea is also very much that corporations are responsible to stakeholders, which means basically everybody. And Vivek Ramaswamy's critique is that by being responsible to stakeholders, being responsible to everybody, you are in effect being responsible to nobody. Whereas in the traditional model where you're responsible to your shareholders and you're just, you know, stick to the bottom line, which is producing profit and abiding by regulations. If you kind of stick to that model, then, you know, that's our best hope of, well, of things running properly, I suppose.
So I think in either case, one has to still deliver against traditional metrics to serve shareholders. Mm-hmm. They're investing their capital in the company principally for an expectation of a return. Now, how you get there is, I think, less different than both camps present, meaning mm-hmm. I think one has to work with stakeholders in order to deliver an acceptable outcome for shareholders. And so when I worked at Timberland for many years, we did focus on all of our stakeholders, our customers, our suppliers, the environment, our employees, in order to deliver good outcomes for our shareholders. Mm-hmm. In our case, the company was publicly traded, but had an interesting capital structure where the family owned Class B shares, and so they controlled the company, even though it was publicly traded. So they were, in fact, the biggest shareholder. And yet, they made decisions that traded off profit in the short term in order to advance the interest of a stakeholder because in the long term, they thought that would benefit them, the shareholders. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's different questions about time horizons and can every one company make those decisions if they're not owned by a family and quasi-private? It's a mm-hmm. fair question. But I do agree with Vivek that measuring all outcomes for stakeholders is complicated. And how do you make trade-offs? My contention is that you have to deliver for shareholders, and you do that via balancing the interests of various stakeholders.
Next time on the Case for Conservation podcast, we'll be talking about coral. My guest is Mike Emsley, Senior Research Scientist at the Australian Institute for Marine Science and Head of the Great Barrier Reef Long-Term Monitoring Program. Mike helps me to demystify the apparent contradiction between UN predictions of future coral loss on the one hand and the recently improving health of the Great Barrier Reef on the other. I hope you'll join us.